we should start. Any question before we start from last time?
The last part of the lecture wasn't very clear. Can you give like a quick summary of what we did? Because like,
yeah.
It's very rushed.
Yeah, we talked about the fact that the, this is actually on. Hall conductance from a band structure point of view, if I have a field band, which is an insulator, is given by the integration of the total integration of Berry curvature within the Brillouin law. So that number is known to be an integer. It has a name. It's called the first Chern number. And then I showed you that in an actual example of the Hordain model, which is basically start from the simplest graphene, but then you add a term that preserves all the symmetries except for time reversal. Actually, it breaks reflection also. But it preserves things like rotation symmetry and translation symmetry. And that model turns out to be an example of a non-trivial Chern band in the sense that the field band, if it's half field, so it has two bands, right? So if you field the lower one and leave the upper one empty, the lower one, which is field, has Chern number plus minus one, depending on the sign of the time reversal breaking term you added. So because it's a two-band model, the Bloch state at each momentum is just a two-dimensional vector, really, right? So at each momentum, if you stay in the lower band, it's a given vector. But that vector changes as you move in k, right? So the fact that the Chern number is non-zero means that it changes in some non-trivial way. Okay. So you can't, in some sense, undo that kind of changing. And that as a result, you get an integer quantum Hall state out of that.
So that Chern number basically just gives you the evolution of that log vector, right?
Yes, basically. In that particular case, because it's a two-band model, the Bloch wave function, you can view it as living on the Bloch sphere.
Yeah.
So then it maps to a problem of how, you have your Brillouin zone, which is a torus, and on each point, there is a state that lives on the Bloch sphere. So you can almost view that as a mapping from torus to a sphere. And then there's a winding number that characterizes such a map, essentially the homotopy class of that map. And that turns out to be exactly the Chern number. So in two-band model, this Chern number notion is actually pretty simple. I mean, it's relatively simple. All right, so today we're going to look at, again, integer quantum Hall, but from a, in many ways, more physical point of view. Forget about momentum space, Brillouin zone. Let's think about the real space, right, which is what you measure physically. Turns out you gain a lot of insights beyond what we've learned from band theory. So the idea is this. Suppose now I have an insulator. Again, two-dimensional. So it may or may not have a non-trivial Hall conductance. But let me assume it's an insulator. And let me think about the following geometry, which is a cylinder. This. Let me call this direction x and this direction y. So this place, I call it y equal to 0. There's an edge here. There's another circular edge at y equal to ly. Let me also say the perimeter of this circle is Lx. Okay. So I assume I put my two-dimensional insulator, I wrap my two-dimensional insulator onto this cylindrical geometry. Okay. And now let me imagine a Gedanken experiment. Well, you can actually do it. Which is through the hole of this cylinder, I put in a time-dependent magnetic field. Okay. But the magnetic field is just parallel to the cylinder. So if my electron just moves on the cylindrical surface, it doesn't see any Lorentz force or anything. So what are the assumptions? Well, as I said, I assume this is an insulator, if you like, a field band. So the bulk, if I'm far away from the edge, this is an insulator, right, by assumption. Or gap. Okay. What I haven't, but just assuming the bulk is an insulator doesn't necessarily mean that your edge has to be insulated. So on the edge, let's not assume anything at this point.
So which is bulk, which is?
So this is the edge. These are the two boundaries of my cylinder. Yeah, and far away from this edge, I call it bulk. And let me also assume that the time dependence is slow, so it changes slowly. So as slow as I want, essentially. Okay. So what is the effect of this B? As I said, the electron doesn't actually see the magnetic field on its own. It doesn't see any Lorentz force or anything. However, it does see a vector potential. So you like the total flux through this cylinder, which is the area integral, you can rewrite that as the integral of the vector potential on the cylinder now. So this is in the interior of that cylinder, but this is on the cylinder surface. Okay. And let's also assume that things are uniform. So this AX is a uniform number, so then you get this. Okay. Of course, everything has a teeth bend. So let me comment that in general, the system at different values of AX are different. So for that, let me digress a little bit and remind you about how vector potential works in quantum mechanics. Just through a very basic example. Some of you may have seen this, but it's still good to review this. So let me have a digression. Let me think about a free particle on a ring. So instead of doing two dimension, let me do one dimension. So that I have a ring. Let me call the coordinate x, which lives between 0 and what, L. Okay, so it's a circle. But let me imagine also having a magnetic field penetrating through the circle enclosed by the ring. So what do I get? Well, my Hamiltonian, since it's a free particle, there's no potential, looks like this. Okay. That's my p squared over 2m, except now I have a vector potential coupling. Or you can rewrite, since let me also assume, again, that A is uniform in x. So this is just a constant. So I can, again, this Hamiltonian is diagonalized in the momentum basis. But because it's a ring, the momentum is quantized to be 2 pi n over L. Okay, so let me assume uniform A. So in general, let's think about what this spectrum looks like for a general A. So this axis is AX. So this is my energy spectrum. Right. So at AX equal to 0, the spectrum is simple. You have this 0, 1, 2 squared, which is 4, stuff like that. Okay. This is not necessarily drawing in scale to scale. But of course, except the 0, 1, every non-zero 1 comes with a double degeneracy, because plus minus p gives you the same energy. Yes.
I'm a little bit lost. The AX, what is the AX, sorry?
Oh, it's the vector potential in the x direction. Sorry. The statement is AX dx equal to the total flux, which is the integral of the B field within the circle.
So the dx is the
x is this. I mean, if you really do a polar coordinate, that's really theta.
X is theta, right?
Yeah, yes, that x over L is the theta, or.
Because what's weird to me is that what we want for out of Stokes' theorem is a circulation integral.
Yes.
It seems that we don't have a circulation integral.
Well, not here you're integrating over this circle. Here you're integrating over this circle. So this is the x direction.
So
it's a cylinder. So the x direction is periodic.
So x is Lx times theta.
Yes.
And is it obvious that, this is probably super obvious, but so a magnetic field that goes that way has a vector potential, which is this way?
At least that's a gauge you can choose.
Okay, you can choose what's that. Okay.
So let's work in that convenient gauge. All right, so here in this problem, Ax is just a number. So you just literally plug this into this and see what happens. So remember, at Ax equal to zero, you have this double degeneracy. And if I have some generic Ax, let's say 0.1 or something, you see that this level moves to upward. And there's a splitting between these two levels and so on. Because one is plus n minus a, the other one is minus n minus a square. So one goes up, one goes down. But then there's a funny thing that happens at ax equal to 2 pi over l. Because you see, p is 2 pi times integer over l. So if ax is 2 pi over l, you recover the exact same spectrum, but you just reshuffle every level. Because one of this level, essentially what you see is one of this level becomes this one. This one goes to this one. This one goes to this one. So you have some relation like this. Right? So this you can literally just see the number. So the lesson is the spectrum looks different from Ax equal to zero unless Ax equal to some 2 pi over L times an integer n. These are all integers. Okay. Right. That seems to be a special feature. And you can ask, is that a coincidence? Is this just a feature of this extremely simple kinetic term only model? That's a fair question. And this is not a coincidence, of course. The real reason why this is true is that you can perform a gauge transform that looks like this. So for every state vector at a position x, I can redefine it through a gauge transform as this. So this is a phase factor, which the phase depends on the coordinate x. But the important thing is this phase factor is somewhat non-trivial. It winds as I go from 0 to L. It winds by 2 pi n. Which is fine because the phase itself is still single value. Because at x equal to L, this phase factor is trivial. But the phase itself winds non-trivial. And you can plug in this gauge transform into this Hamiltonian. If you remember, if your state vector transformed as e to the I alpha, your vector potential has a gauge transform that's partial x alpha. For example, the x component. So what happens is that ax goes to ax minus partial x times 2 pi m x over l, which is the phase factor here. That gives you zero, since this is my ax. Okay. And you are you get back to the exactly the same Hamiltonian as AX equals 0.
Sorry, why is 0?
So AX is this number. And I perform this gauge transform. And gauge transform means that I should change AX by the derivative of this phase factor. So if you plug in the number, you realize that it's 0. Right? Partial X, X gives you constant.
But doesn't that work for any constant AX, like AX, whatever number it is, I can know?
Yeah, that's the thing. If you want this number to be single value, this M has to be integer. Because X equal to L, you want this phase factor to be trivial, because it's a ring. You want everything to be single value.
In the previous lecture, didn't we want it to be multi-valued, so?
No, the phase factor, the real space, the real space wave function, you still want it to be single value, because otherwise it's a different problem. For example, you can choose some random real number here. That's a fine gauge transform. Except if you do this, naively you recover the same Hamiltonian, but technically you are not in the same Hilbert space, because now your boundary condition is that this equal to e to the I 2 pi r times x plus l. Your boundary condition becomes something like that. Right? So even though you have the same Hamiltonian, you're not exactly having the same Hilbert space. It's only when this r is integer, you recover the same Hamiltonian and the same Hilbert space.
Yeah, it's in the domain.
Sorry?
It's in the domain of...
Yeah. And in fact, sometimes people do such gauge transform, even for non-integer fields. They get rid of the vector potential, but work with a funny boundary condition. Sometimes there's some convenience associated with that. But let's not do that here. Okay. So the lesson is, at this special value of AX, you can the physics should be exactly the same. At most, you relabel the states a little bit. Because this kind of transformation is like relabeling state. And the relabeling shouldn't change your physics. In fact, physicists have a fancy name for relabeling. It's called gauge transform. And by the way, this kind of gauge transform is called large gauge transform. Because it winds non-trivially.
So sorry, can you say more detail about the large gauge?
Yeah, the thing is, this alpha, if you view this as alpha, this alpha doesn't have a compact support. Sorry, it doesn't have a contractible support. Mm-hmm. So it's non-zero throughout the entire circle. The fact that it's legal because it winds in some integer. Because usual alpha is more like it's zero most of the other places, and then non-zero some bump. Right? So that kind of small gauge transform that doesn't give you interesting argument like this. Okay. So the lesson is, even if I make my Hamiltonian much more complicated, right? I may have more than one particle. I may have 10 to the 23rd. I may have some weird interaction, weird potential. But as long as my AX is this value, I can do a large gauge transform and then recover the same Hamiltonian. So the spectrum should be the same. But I'm not guaranteed that the state will remain the same. Okay?
So by basically doing this gauge transform, you want AX to be 0 at particular values of X.
No, it's identically 0, because AX here is uniform.
Oh, it's identical.
Yeah. This alpha is not uniform, but A is uniform. Okay.
So this just means that your AX is like periodic now?
In some sense. You have to be a little bit careful exactly what you mean by periodic, but the spectrum is periodic in AX. That's true.
Does something special happen at pi by L? Because we get back like...
Now, if you have other symmetries, yes, but in general, you know.
In this particular case, because like we started off with two degenerate states and
yeah, that separate. Yeah, you have some feature, but that's special to this particular problem.
Okay, I understand like the gauge transform is going to give me the same physics.
Yeah.
But I don't like related that with the spectrum.
Which with the spectrum?
With the spectrum.
I don't know. The statement is this is really a relabeling. So the statement is at AX equal to this value, by doing a relabeling of state, I get back the same Hamiltonian.
Oh, okay.
Which means the spectrum should be the same, up to some relabeling. Right, which is what's happening here. There is a relabeling here. Right, this state becomes this. And, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's the digression. So now let's go back to the quantum Hall example, right, to the actual cylindrical geometry you want to consider. But as I said, by the way, sorry, one last comment. What's really important is not the exact value of AX. It turns out that because AX is, after all, is not even gauging variant. What do I mean by that? What's really important is the total flux, which is the loop integral of AX, which in this case means it's 2 pi m. Right. So the statement is, and remember 2 pi is really, if you put in the right unit, it's hc over e times the integer. Or you can call this an integer number times the flux quantum. So the statement is, if I have a ring, and if the total flux threading that ring is an integer multiple of the flux quantum, then the spectrum should be identical. Essentially, I'm doing the same physics. So that's the gauging variance thing. So now, go back to this. It's more or less the same thing. I mean, except okay, I have a cylinder, so there's an extra dimension here. But this argument makes no use of the fact that I only have one dimension. Right. So the same argument applies, which means if my time evolution is such that I start from, let's say, zero magnetic field. So yes.
Sorry, I still don't see why when you relabel them,
yeah,
you're going to have like the same. I know that it's like almost the same structure, but
yeah,
you have like different levels and it's not exactly the same for me. I don't see the relabeling.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. Let me be slower. So for example, take m equal to 1, right? So ax equal to 2 pi over l. The state that's originally at zero momentum now has, oh, it's still at zero momentum, but now it has energy 0 minus 2 pi over L square, which is 2 pi over L square, which is this one. Okay. So what does this thing do? Well, if you have a wave function, which is something like psi x integral dx, right? That's a generic state. And if you perform this change, all right, let's just take the simplest state. Originally, at zero momentum, your state is literally this, right? That's the equal superposition of all state. So now you perform this transform. What do you get? This is what you get. Sorry, m is 1. But this state should be familiar. This is momentum equal to 1 state. So that is saying, after this gauge transform, what you're effectively doing is to shift originally momentum equal to p state to momentum p plus 1 state. I mean, 1 is this one. So you're literally just shifting all the momentum by 1. This is where you get this. All right, so
could you explain what dimensionless thing you did there? Let's see why. And like that m is the integer, right?
Yeah.
That's right, okay.
So your, what's your question? Your question is why is 2 pi equal to hc over e? Because h bar equal to 1, c equal to 1, e equal to 1. But h is 2 pi h bar. Yeah. I mean, of course, it's a little bit more than that, but you can check that this has the right dimension of magnetic flux. Yeah, I'll be using 2 pi and hc over e quite interchangeably, depending on whether we want to see the more formal or mathy structure, or you want to actually have a sense of what's really going on. OK, so go back to this example. So if the time evolution of the B field is such that the phi at t equal to 0 is 0, so we start from 0 magnetic field, but then evolve slowly and until a long time later, let's call it capital T, such that this becomes 2 pi. Right? Imagine such an evolution. Now, I've spent quite a bit of time telling you that T equal to 0 and T equal to capital T, the spectrums are identical. At least I relabel some states. At most, I relabel some states. Okay. So now, one statement is if the entire system is gapped, entire system meaning bulk plus boundary, bulk plus edge. And I've already assumed that the bulk is gapped. Right, that's my starting assumption. So which really means if the edge is also gapped, then I should return to the, if I start from the ground state, then I should return to the ground state of the original Hamiltonian. Zero, which is the ground state of my original Hamiltonian. Okay, so up to possibly a Berry phase, but let's not think about the Berry phase here. Okay. There could be a phase factor, doesn't really matter. Right. But the thing is, the ground state doesn't change. However, if the edge happens to be gapless, then the adiabatic assumption cannot be true. But I'm, you know, this A field I'm switching on is of order, because this now is of order 2 pi, or order 1, if you like. So this A field is of order 1 over Lx. So by edge being gapless, I really mean that the gap on the edge is of order 1 over Lx. Just like the usual, the one-dimensional metal you've seen last week. Okay? So if that's true, then in principle, the adiabatic assumption may break down. Then what could happen is that, well, this A field, which is of order 1 over L, in principle could induce a transition out of ground state. Right? Which means the state at the final time will be some state possibly excited of the original Hamiltonian. Okay. But as I said, the bulk is gapped. So the adiabatic argument should still work within the bulk. So the only difference, or the only excitation, if there is any excitation at all, should just live on the boundary. Should only live on boundary. So what I mean by live on boundary, so there is a clear meaning, which is if this is my boundary and this is my bulk. So one example of excitation that lives only on boundary is an excited state with wave function that looks like this, right? Meaning, let's say this is your, call it y, meaning the wave function as a function of y. Okay, there may be some dependence on x, but let me not care too much. Decays exponentially as I move away from the boundary. Okay. So there is a clear notion of this state only living on the boundary. Yes?
The other question, going back to the free particle on
yes.
the example, I guess we just want to understand the main point. Is the main point that A is periodic, that it's proportional to 2 pi over L times an integer, is that the main point?
Yes, method? More or less, yes. Or the more precise statement is phi is periodic, because phi is the ultimate gauge invariant notion, while A is not. But in a convenient gauge, A is periodic. And the meaning of periodic, you have to be careful. It means that the problem returns to itself. It doesn't necessarily mean a particular state returns to itself. In fact, you know, there might be some relabeling and so on.
And also, can you explain here why the gap going as 1 over L means that AX goes between
the... Yes. So the statement is this. Suppose I have, let's just take a two-state example. And suppose I have a gap between the two states of order delta. Now I gradually turn on some perturbation, in this case A. Right? So as I turn on A, this two level, you know, so what I want, yeah, okay. So if I want adiabatic evolution, then I want this gap to be, to never close, this two level to never touch each other. Okay? So if they evolve like this, so that it's gapped throughout, then I'm okay, right? But there could be a point in between, at some special value of ax, for example, that this two level touch. In general, that could happen. Right. But you would expect that for this to happen, that the a, which is a perturbation, should be of the same order of delta. Right. If a is always, let's say, a million times smaller than delta, then you don't expect this touching to ever happen. Right. You expect a tiny change here, a tiny change here. And then the gap will always remain open, and then you can use your adiabatic theorem. Okay? So this touching is only possible. It's not necessarily there, but it's possible when A is at least of the same order of delta. Okay?
Shouldn't we expect something more like, instead of like 1 over L, I don't know if I'm being nitpicky, but shouldn't we spend something more like a square root? Like dependence, 1 over square root L.
Why is square root? So
because I don't know. I'm thinking of the fact because a seems to be shifting the spectrum, the momentum eigenvalues in a linear fashion.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Which means that it is changing the energy eigenvalues in a quadratic fashion.
Not necessarily. You are thinking at the very bottom of that quadratic dispersion, right? Typically, that's not necessarily true. For example, take the, you know, one-dimensional tight binding model, half filling. Remember that dispersion, which looked like this. If I'm here, the dispersion is quadratic. But generically, if I have some Fermi surface, this is linear. So the linear is usually more generic than the quadratic, or simply because it comes with lower order. But there are special situations where it's quadratic, and then the analysis has to be redone. But if it's quadratic, it's only worse. If now this is much larger, you have an even worse problem with the adiabaticity.
Wait, so when we say AX is the order of 1 over L,
yeah.
shouldn't we be saying something of the sort like the amount that AX changes over some period of time is such that you don't excite anything, right? Like, you know, you make this sort of adiabatic.
No. Before I start to make adiabatic statement, I have to say the instantaneous Hamiltonian has a gap, right? So how do I know that? I know that if this is of order one, AX is of order one over L, then that will be always true because this two level will change by some number one over L. Doesn't matter. But if everything is of order one over L, I have a problem. Yeah, that's it. So the fact that, so if somehow this tiny amount of AX can induce a transition out of the ground state, it must mean that the gap between the excited state and the ground state is also at most of order one over L. It can be even smaller. Yes?
And sorry, one more question is, can you just explain again what you mean when you write down the excitation should only live on the boundary?
Yeah, so what I mean is, because if I move sufficiently away from the boundary, yeah, one working assumption here is that there is some length scale, let me call it C. And if I'm sufficiently away from the boundary by C, or much larger than C, then the bulk looks identical as, you know, a periodic boundary condition, for example, right, with no boundary. Okay. So you know, if you want to rigorously justify that assumption, it turns out to be a little bit non-trivial, but physically it makes sense, right? It will be weird if the physics deep inside the bulk for an insulator depends so sensitively on the boundary. Okay. So let's assume that. Now assuming that, then it means that within the bulk, the adiabatic assumption is still true. So after this adiabatic, this slow evolution that changes my phi by 2 pi, my bulk should remain the same, right? If I'm far enough away, far enough from the boundary, I shouldn't observe any difference within the bulk between t equal to capital T and t equal to 0. However, that may not necessarily be true if I'm close to the boundary within some length scale C. And in fact, for integer quantum hole, I will show you that this is manifestly so. You do have some boundary excitation. Yes?
So like physically, it means that you're like sending signals or something, and they're going to be like damped when they enter?
Yes. So if you, yeah, physically it means if you try to shoot in something, some electron here, through the boundary, the electron can move freely on the boundary. That has no problem. But if you want the electron to actually tunnel in, it's exponentially hard.
So it cannot like go inside.
Yeah, basically. And that's more or less another way to say that the bulk is gapped. But yeah. All right, so yeah, that's slower than, yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's conclusion one. I should expect to get back the same state within the bulk, but there might be some excitation on the boundary. If the boundary is gapless. So we haven't shown that yet. But now let's show that. Let's show that by asking the following question. That is, throughout this procedure of turning on the flux from 0 to 2 pi, how much charge has flown from the right boundary to the left boundary, from essentially y equal to 0 to y equal to ly, of course, in the y direction. Okay. Essentially, I'm asking, during the process of turning on this magnetic field from 0 to 2 pi, how much charge has gone from here to here? Well, because of charge conservation, you can just calculate that by cutting a surface here and measure the total current that has passed through this surface. Right? Doesn't matter which surface you choose within the bulk because of charge conservation. Well, of course, that assumption relies on the fact that because the bulk, you should expect the bulk to return to the exact same ground state SP4, there's no charge accumulation after this process within the bulk, you know, at any place. And then you can see that the total charge flow, of course, by definition, is equal to the integral of the current in y direction times dt. That's the definition. And of course, again, by definition, you have the current density times dt dx integral. But as I said, but by definition, the current density is the conductivity times the electric field. But the bulk is insulating, which means it has no longitudinal conductivity. Sigma xx should be zero. There's only a Hall conductivity, which means this should be given by sigma xy, well, sorry, sigma yx times ex dt dx. Right, essentially, the Hall conductance times the electric field that's going on in the x direction. Okay, so you say, where does that electric field come from? Well, you have a time-dependent magnetic field. Of course, that induces an electric field. And if you remember, Ex is dAx dt. Right? So plug it in, what do you get? You get, well, for one thing, sigma yx equal to minus sigma xy. So let me just pull that out. It's a constant. Also, let me assume everything is uniform in x direction. And then the integral over x is just lx. So now I just integrate over ex dt. But ex, as I said, is dax dt. So integrating that over dt is just becomes ax. Right. So this is just minus sigma xy lx ax between t equal to capital T and zero. But this combination is nothing but the flux through the cylinder. So what I end up getting is just sigma xy times 2 pi. And as I said, because the bulk must return to the exact original ground state, this charge flow must somehow come from the edge. Because, you know, if within this, for this boundary condition, if I have a net charge flow from this, from the right to left, and no charge accumulation within the bulk, that must means that this boundary, this edge has lost some charge, and this edge has accumulated some charge. Okay, that's the only place, by assumption, that anything interesting can happen. Which means, if sigma xy is not zero. Yes?
Sorry, could you just define the variables again in the, like, the capital J and the lowercase j and the sigma?
Yeah, sorry. JY is the current, total current in y direction. Little jy is the current density. JY over LX. Assuming it's uniform. Of course, the real definition is something like jy dx. Yes?
Aren't we already assuming that the current is only flowing at the edges if we were down any other integral over one dimension?
No. I'm only saying at the two ends of the process, interesting things only happen on the edge. That argument doesn't tell you what happens in between.
So
this argument tells you if you actually have a Hall conductivity, which we calculate from the bulk, which is in principle calculable from the bulk information, then in that process, the bulk cannot be completely bored. Some charge has to flow through.
So should we integrate over the surface then, over the...
Sorry, which integrate?
For the current.
This one?
Wouldn't be more interesting to integrate, like, because when you integrate over dx, which is only one dimensional, so.
Yeah, because I'm I'm integrating the current in this direction, and I'm, you know, the definition is that the total current, which defined as, you know, if I cut a surface and that's the total charge flow through in unit time. That's the integral of this current density.
Over the surface.
Over the surface, but the surface is one dimensional.
Yeah, so that's like phi or something.
Yeah, that's like phi. Yeah, it's a circle. Yeah, it's a surface in a two-dimensional space, which is a one-dimensional. So if I'm doing 3D, then I should integrate something like dx, dz. All right. So okay, now coming back. If sigma xy not equal to 0, of course that means this number is not 0. But this number, as I said, is the charge transfer from right to left edge. And because the edge just, as I said, the final state, oh, first of all, that means the edge cannot come back to its final state because the charge is now different, right? That means your right charge now has lost this amount of charge and your left charge has, you know, gained this amount of charge. The charges are different, so the state cannot be the same, obviously. So now I've shown already that if sigma xy is not zero, the charge, the edge must somehow change, not remain in the ground state, which means the edge gap has to be at most of order one over L. So the edge must be gapless. Okay. The other thing is, since it's just an excited state on the edge, the charge better be an integer. Right? What could be the excited state about? It's, for example, if you like, think about the free fermion state. So all the free fermion state are, you know, take your Fermi level and fill all the energy levels below that Fermi level. Right, so you fill states one by one. So an excited state is like filling some extra, you know, electron states. In fact, that argument generalizes to even interacting systems if you put in some assumption. So it's natural to expect that this number should be an integer.
Okay.
No, it's an excited state on the edge.
Right.
Right. And this number is the difference between the charge of that excited state on the edge and the ground state of that edge. So then, if you assume that all your excitations carry integer charge, which is of course true for all free fermion state, and it's true if I, you know, even if I perturb the free fermion state by some weak interaction. No, even on the edge. Even on the edge, at most, you have some gapless modes, but so what? Your excited state is like filling one more mode or two more modes or something. So that's the statement. So as long as all excitations carry integer charge, which is true for free fermion state. And even with a weak interaction. But let me not say too much about that. Essentially, some adiabatic argument will show you that. So what does that tell you? Well, that tells you sigma xy must be an integer over 2 pi, or if you like to put back the natural unit, it's e squared over h times integer. So this is the same result I derived for you from band theory, Berry curvature, and so on last time. But this argument, in some sense, is more powerful and less powerful. It's more powerful in the sense that it's more general. I haven't told you a single thing about band structure. I haven't even assumed I have lattice translation symmetry. Right? Band structure only makes sense if I actually have discrete lattice translation symmetry and I can label every state by lattice momentum. But for this argument to work, I don't even need that. I only need to assume that my bulk is an insulator with this property, the property that all excitations carry integer charge. Okay? But of course, the momentum space picture has an advantage that given a momentum space structure, meaning band structure, you can actually calculate that number. So this argument by itself doesn't tell you how to calculate that number. If I hand you, for example, a Hamiltonian.
You again did some dimensionless thing there.
Sorry?
You again did some dimensionless thing.
Yeah, yeah. So
wouldn't there be a C?
So this E squared over H is called the natural unit of conductance. You can check that it has the right dimension with conductance. And for quantum system, for quantum many-body system where conductivity shows some quantum nature, you often see this number. And in fact, as I mentioned last time, because this is an integer, it's so robust, you know, it basically tolerates very little error bar. So people actually measure H by measuring this number. So, yes.
But in our last lecture, we don't even consult to the bound structure when deriving this formula. We use the Brillouin zone, the gauge transformation in the Brillouin zone.
Yeah, we
can assume that this is an insulator.
No. But there you at least assume that the Brillouin zone exists, or the notion of Brillouin zone makes sense. Now, if I put in some disorder,
I see.
Brillouin zone no longer makes sense. Or if I put in some interaction so that these block states are no longer my eigenstates. How do I think about that? Well, it turns out this is huge. Yeah. So this is an extremely powerful argument. But of course, the only negative is it doesn't tell you exactly how to calculate that integer. So let's resume in 5 minutes. Should be gapless, but should have the following property, which is really repeating what I said there, which is, let's say take, for example, the Ly, let's take the y equal to zero edge, for example. Okay. So the statement is the edge should have the property that the total charge on that edge changes by one upon a 2 pi flux threading process. That time dependence of magnetic flux is called the flux threading.
I'm sorry, can we put down that blackboard so I
can't see that?
Try to keep wasn't there another one? Where we had,
that's
the one that you're right. Oh, sorry. Okay.
You have a question?
It's fine. Okay. I thought that there was a third black.
Oh, okay.
Behind.
Yeah. So the edge should have this property. Okay. So if I take my edge, think of it as a circle now or a ring, but the property is that if I slowly thread a 2 pi flux into the disk enclosed by this ring, the total charge on this ring changes by one. Right, it's a pretty weird property. This property has a name. The name is called chiral anomaly. Some of you may have seen or will see this sort of thing in your QFT class or QFT book.
Okay. So is it the intuitive chiral anomaly also a topological effect?
Yes. So this is the special property I want for my edge state. So now you can ask, what is the simplest? I mean, there are probably zillions of states that can satisfy this. Or what is the simplest such state? The answer is that it's a state called chiral fermion. If you like, it's a Weyl fermion, one plus one dimension. So it looks like this. Let me do it in momentum states. And let me now just focus, for example, on that edge. And as I said, the y direction is not going to be very interesting, because all the, I assume, everything that's interesting will be exponentially localized around y equal to 0. So let's focus on the x direction. So the x direction, I can still have translational symmetry, so I can still label everything by momentum, right? So let me just write down a theory. I won't tell you where that, at this point, let me not tell you where that theory comes from, but let me just write down that theory. So it's a summation over kx, let's say around some momentum kx, momentum 0. The state looks like this. There's a constant, let me call it v, it's the velocity, times kx, ckx. That's it. It's probably the simplest Hamiltonian you can even imagine. But it's weird, because if you think about the familiar 1D type binding model, right? Let's say if I focus near here, suppose my chemical potential is at 0. So if I focus near here, then there are two such things. There is a fermion that's moving right. There is a fermion moving left. So moving right or left means that my velocity, which is defined as the derivative energy with respect to k, it's plus, it's positive here, and it's negative here. So I have both, which makes sense. So that just means my fermion can move either left or right. That's what real life people do. But this one is not, right? If you take the energy derivative with momentum, it's just positive. So it only moves right. It doesn't move left. And now if I put in a gauge field, let's say just the vector potential, by gauge invariance, you just take the minimum coupling, you should get this. Okay, so this we call right moving. Left moving simply means you have a minus sign here in front. Okay. So what does the spectrum look like? Well, let's again imagine that the x direction, has length Lx with periodic boundary condition, then I have kx equal to 2 pi over L n Lx. Right, now let me do the same thing as I did here, except the Hamiltonian is different. Let me draw the spectrum. So, and as a function of A. Right, starting from 0, end at 2 pi over L. Okay, what do I get? So this is 2 pi over Lx. Okay, what do I get? At Ax equal to 0, this can take any, for convenience, let me shift everything by 1/2 here. It's just a constant shift. If you like, that comes from the boundary condition, but it's not very important. Actually, let me not do that. Let me just do this. But add a tiny bit of positive chemical potential to avoid complicated things like zero mode. Okay? So the spectrum looks like this. It's now no longer quadratic, for one thing, it's linear. And more importantly, it has both positive and negative modes. Right? Because this n can take any integer. Right? So at Ax equal to 0, the spectrum looks just like this. Now again, at Ax equal to 2 pi over L, the effect is to shift everything by 1. So you get exactly the same spectrum. Actually, let me draw it bigger, just in case you can't see it. So it's like this, and this. OK, so the spectrum looks identical. But if you ask, how do these two spectrum connect? Or you ask, as you continuously change ax from 0 to 2 pi over l, how do these things go? Well, you see what happens is they do like this. Right, so everything shifts down by 1 unit. What does that mean? Well, that means, let's say if your chemical potential is slightly positive to begin with, that means all the negative energy levels and the zero energy level are filled. Right? You have some fermions occupying it. But now you gradually evolve your AX. What happens? This level becomes this. This level becomes this. But then this is an empty level to begin with. Now you just evolve it. Things are not going to jump suddenly. So after this 2 pi over, when you reach this 2 pi over L vector potential, this level is now empty. So if you compare this with this, it's the identical spectrum, but then you have one particle missing.
Can you repeat that, sir?
Sorry?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, so the statement is that when you evolve AX, this level shift down. At AX equal to 2 pi over L, they shift down, essentially this shift to here, this shift to here.
Like this.
But now if you start from a state where all these are filled, and all these are empty, now you evolve. At the end of the day, you get all these are filled, because they come from here. But this one, which is originally filled, is actually empty, because it comes from here. So now you have the same spectrum, but you have one particle less. Sorry, actually what I draw is correspond to this one. So maybe I should do it in the audience. So this means when I have an edge state like this, I do satisfy this condition, which means this is a reasonable edge state that lives on the boundary of an insulator with Hall conductance 1 over 2 pi. And likewise, because if I have minus 1 charge shift by a 2 pi flux on the left edge, for example, then on my right edge, I should expect delta Q equal to plus 1 upon a 2 pi flux threading, which means the simplest edge state is now a left moving fermion, which is really a minus sign here. So the particles only move left. And then you go through the argument, you see that the trajectory is inverted, and you get a plus total charge. So now let's make this more general. So this is just the simplest state. So I can make it more complicated. But let's suppose it's still some free fermion state. Then I can make the following statement, which, I mean, I won't prove it to you, but it's kind of intuitively obvious, which is the number of left fermion or left mode. Minus the number of right mode. In general, I can have some number of left mode and some number of right mode. Let's say on the y equal to 0 edge, equal to, you know, the number of right mode minus the number of left mode on this y equal to ly edge, the opposite, equal to 2 pi times sigma xy. And this is an integer. Okay. So relation like this is sometimes known as bulk boundary correspondence. Yes.
I have some question on the right moving and left moving. It seems that the right moving mode decreased by one, left moving increased by one.
Let me see. Okay, did I screw up the algebra? I think I'm okay, right? Because it's it's 2 pi n, I mean, it's really m, 2 pi n over lx minus a.
Yes.
So because of the minus, because this v is plus, so it goes down.
So what about the left moving and that equals to lh?
Sorry?
What was about the left moving at that h?
Oh, okay. You can try the same game with a minus here. You will find that, essentially, because then you get a minus sign here, the levels move this way instead. And now you have this level, which is filled, and then becomes here, which is filled. So you have one extra charge.
Yeah, so I'm saying that it seems the charge is changed by 2 instead of 1.
What?
Because you left moving.
No, you have a right moving on the right edge that changes charge by 1. And minus 1, and then left moving on the other edge, which changes by charge by minus 1 or plus 1. The total change of charge should be 0. I mean, that's charge conservation.
Yes. So what I'm saying, do we have the left moving mode and the left charge?
Yeah, I think right moving I think it's the right moving on the left edge and the right moving on the in this case, left charge and left moving on the right edge.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they should sum to 0, basically. They should sum to, Okay, so this is a pretty profound relation. It's saying a topological property in the bulk, which you can calculate, for example, from Chern number, take your band structure and so on, get an integer. That tells you if I have an open boundary condition. In general, I can add some funny Hamiltonian extra terms in the Hamiltonian on the edge. So things can change. Right? All this number can change if I have enough. For example, I can always, instead of, so that, for example, this mode means that the energy momentum relation is like this, right? But I can perfectly imagine adding some funny Hamiltonian term to make it look like this. Right? Suppose my chemical potential cuts through this line. Now you count how many modes I have. Well, there are 2 right moving modes and 1 left moving mode. So the number of right moving modes, for example, is not going to be extremely robust. You can change that. But this difference you can't change. And that's dictated by the Hall conductance in the bulk. And in particular, if I have a purely one-dimensional, let's say a 1D wire. That's not the boundary of any non-trivial bulk. Then it means that this number is 0 because there's no bulk. And then the number of left moving modes should always agree with the number of right moving modes. Yes.
Does it mean that we couldn't get that if we have a band that is full?
Sorry, if
our band is full of electrons, we cannot. Can we have like a difference of left modes and right modes?
If you have band in 2D or in 1D? Sorry. Well, maybe I didn't understand your question.
If you have electrons, like the band is full of electrons.
Yeah.
We cannot.
Oh, no. If you have 1D band that's full of electrons, you never have anything like this. You don't even have any left moving, right moving. Right. But even in one dimension, if I have a partially filled band, in general, I can have some number of left moving, some number of right moving. The statement is that if that band structure comes from a purely one-dimensional lattice model, for example, then that these two numbers should always agree. Is that your question? Or?
So in 2D, then?
In 2D, the statement is, when I say the band is full, that statement already means I'm actually on periodic boundary. Because it's only on periodic boundary condition, all the momentums are well defined. Because I have the full translation symmetry. This picture, strictly speaking, doesn't have translation symmetry in the in the y direction. So it's not guaranteed to begin with that I can label all my states with the momentum in the y direction. But I know that if I'm far away from the edge, that effect should be tiny, should be negligible. But close to the edge, I start to see the fact I don't have I don't have Y translation, and then I shouldn't stick with my original picture. I thought I have a field band. Okay, so that may be a bit abstract since I've just told you, okay, this kind of edge structure will satisfy the requirement of this adiabatic flux threading, blah, blah, blah. How do you know that you can actually have this? So let me actually show you an example. In fact, this is the historically first example of chain insulator. That's also where the name of integer quantum Hall effect come from. It's the physics of lambda level. So Landau level as an integer quantum Hall effect. So the setup is I have two-dimensional electron gas. So now forget about lattice. Let's imagine there's no potential to begin with, only kinetic term, possibly with a chemical potential. But under a large magnetic field in the z direction. Okay. Historically, you have this electrons moving in this plane, but then you have a possibly gigantic magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. Okay. So let's assume this is uniform. I have a uniform magnetic field. And let's assume that the potential for now to be just trivially zero. Or if you like a constant, it's like a chemical potential. So for now, let's neglect the potential because it's a constant. Also, let's work in a convenient gauge. Let's take what's known as the Landau gauge. I mean, you can work it without any other gauge you like. It's pretty much always solvable, but this is particularly illuminating for our purpose. So let's take a gauge where ax is 0 and ay equal to bx. And you can take the curl of that and see that it's a speed. Okay. The nice thing about this gauge is that translation symmetry in y direction is manifestly capped. Okay, because nothing depends on y. Yes?
Can you define the x and y directions on the diagram?
Oh, okay. Let's say I take this as my x and this is my y.
Wait, what, b of x? Or is it only of x?
Oh, it's just the chemical potential. So V is the potential. Let's solve the single body problem. It's the Hamiltonian is P squared over 2m plus V.
Yeah, V of R, right?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Right, let's now solve the single body problem. Forget about CC dagger. Let's solve the Schrodinger equation. Well, because translation symmetry in y direction is capped, so I'm allowed to label, or at least partially label, all my states as an eigenfunction, eigenvector of translation symmetry, which is momentum eigenstate in y direction. So operationally, what that means is that I'm going to take a form of my wave function as e to the I, or it's essentially separation of variance. Because of the translation symmetry in Y, this will guarantee to work. Okay. Now the Hamiltonian is what? It's essentially px squared over 2m plus py. Minus vx squared over 2m. And just plugging in this form of vector potential into the standard kinetic term.
Wait, isn't the translation symmetry then preserved on the other side?
It's not. it's not manifestly, right? Because there's an x here. You move in the x direction, the ay changes.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
Of course, that you can gauge that away, but okay, there's some other subtlety with that. Let me not go into it. Now, plugging this kind of Hamiltonian into this, what do you get? Well, that simply means that you can replace this py. Remember, now this px, py, they are operators, and x, they are operators. Right? But this form of Hamiltonian means that you can replace this operator by a number ky. So now this becomes px. I mean, if you like, you can replace this px by I partial x or something. Plus, let me take out, let me do some rewriting. X minus ky over b squared. Okay. So y direction basically has disappeared because of the momentum. I can say. So what is this Hamiltonian? Well, it's a harmonic oscillator. Stare at it. It's a harmonic oscillator. It's a harmonic oscillator, but centered with a quadratic potential centered around ky over b. Right. So it's a harmonic oscillator. Okay. And also the omega, if you remember, this piece of this number should be is supposed to be 1/2 times m omega squared in a standard harmonic oscillator language, which means the omega of that harmonic oscillator, let me call it omega c, is equal to b over m. And this is known as the cyclotron frequency. So classically, this is the frequency. If you shoot an electron under a magnetic field, it goes circular. That's the frequency of that circular motion. Okay. So now let's look at the ground state of this harmonic oscillator. Let's just entirely focus on the ground state. What is that? Well, that just means that my psi labeled by ky, so it's the ground state. That's equal to e to the I ky y times the wave function or the ground state wave function of the harmonic oscillator, but centered around ky over b. So remember, this is just a simple Gaussian. So of course, the energy is just 1/2 times h bar omega c. It's the zero point energy of the harmonic oscillator. Yes.
You have p's and k's, but are
they
supposed to be the same?
Yeah, k is the eigenvalue, so it's a number. P is an operator. If you like, p is I partial. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the important thing is this is a number that's independent of ky. Remember, ky can, if I have an infinite plane, ky can take any value. There are infinite many ky I can take. But they all have this exactly same energy. So I have a huge degeneracy, in fact. But there are other things that depend on ky. For example, the expectation of the x coordinate. That's just given by where I center my potential around, so that's ky over b. And you can see the variance of x. That's how much the Gaussian gets spread in the x direction. That's roughly, I think, 1/2 b. Yeah, but the important thing is it's proportional to square root b. So what does that mean? Well, as I said, there are infinitely many ky's I can take on an infinite plane. But let's be a little bit more concrete, because how infinite is it? So suppose I have a finite system of Lx times Ly. And they may be periodic, maybe open. For this purpose, it doesn't really matter. So then how many states are there? The number of states. Well, since I have a finite ky, a finite ly, then ky equals to 2 pi over ly ny. I mean, this is strictly true for periodic boundary condition, but even for open, it's roughly true. You have some shift. Well, that means here for each state, x is a Gaussian that's centered around 2 pi over b times ly and y. I just plug in that, this. But if I want to say x belongs to, since it's a Gaussian centered around this, I want x to be belonging to zero, between 0 and lx, for example. Then that means ny has to take value between 0 and this funny number, b times lx ly over 2 pi. So the number of integers I have within this interval is the number of states. So the number of states equal to this number, essentially, the integer part. But if it's large enough, it doesn't really matter. But b lx ly is the total flux. So it's the total flux over 2 pi. Now if I ask you to recover all the correct unit of h bar, c, and e, you know what to put in for the 2 pi. It's over hc over e, which is the flux quantum. Essentially, each flux quanta gives me one state in the lowest in a given Landau level. So, sorry, by the way, this is known as a Landau level. You know, stick with a specified state of the harmonic oscillator, for example, the ground state, and then scan through all the KYs. Okay. So we started 5 minutes. So historically, this is the first discovered term band in some sense, right? So there is a way to convert, because now the dispersion, the energy is like, there is a 1/2 omega c where I have many states, let's say if I vary ky. And then there's some excited state of the harmonic oscillator, right? So if my chemical potential is here, then all the states here are filled. So that sounds like an insulator, right? You have something that looks like a band and all states are filled. So this doesn't look very much like a band, you know, because symmetry seems to be different and so on. But it turns out it can be converted to a band. I won't explain exactly how to do that. But historically, it was converted to a band structure calculation. The Chern number was calculated through the Berry phase formula I told you last time. And that's done by in the famous TKNN paper. If you're curious, you literally just Google TKNN. That's the paper you'll get in 1982. That's basically how Thouless got his Nobel Prize. But, if you do the calculation, you see that sigma xy equal to 1 over 2 pi, or if you like, e squared over h for this field and all of it. But there is a quick way to see that without calculating the actual Chern number, which is a little bit involved. The way is to ask what happens on the edge. So let me show you that it actually has the chiral edge state that I promised. Yes.
So can you just say what is a Chern band?
So a Chern band is a band where the Chern number defined as the total integral of the Berry curvature is non-zero. So which means you have a non-zero Hall conductance. So in this case, it has Chern number 1. The Chern number is the total integral of that Berry curvature. Divided by 2 pi, of course. So let me ask what happens on the edge. So now suppose I have an edge. So what does an edge mean? I can model the edge as follows. So I can modify my potential. Now before, the potential is just a constant, it's completely flat. But now let me model my potential like this. So I have my chemical potential here, but then I do it this way. Suppose this is my chemical potential. Do it like this. So the real potential is C, if you like, is this. Okay. So if I'm at, let's say there's an x0, if I'm at x smaller than x0, I'm still more or less within this range, so I fill all the states. But if I'm at x much larger than x0, this potential penalty is so large that I should leave the states empty. Right. So now if I expand x around x0, let me call it delta x, then this potential is, I can expand to linear order at some number, it's a order one constant, times delta x. It's just linear expansion. But delta x, remember, x is more or less within some uncertainty. Uncertainty is set by the spread of the Gaussian wave packet, which is the Gaussian factor, which is 1 over square root b. So within that uncertainty, I can more or less identify x as momentum ky over b. Which means delta x, I can identify that as ky minus some constant, let's call it ky zero, naught over b. So now what's my Hamiltonian? Well, remember the kinetic term is flat, so there's nothing there from kinetic term. But then this potential term becomes a over b times ky minus some constant. This is the chiral fermion state I promised there. So in this way, you can see they're quite explicit. Right? Essentially, because of the special feature of the Landau level, x is somehow locked with ky up to some uncertainty, which is just a number. So if I neglect that uncertainty, a potential that's linear in x is basically a potential that's linear in ky. And this is your edge state. Right. Essentially, you think of the states like this. So these are your ky. These are your ky. And all right, yes?
I'm sure you explained it, I just missed it. So we're saying that V of R is V of X minus mu.
Yeah.
I kind of got lost where, because that's different from what we had over here. So this is just a...
Yeah, sorry, maybe I should have a minus mu.
We started with a constant potential.
Yeah, we start with a constant potential. But now we want to create an edge. The constant potential, if I'm at infinite space, doesn't come with an edge. So the way to create an edge is to modify your potential to have an upturn near the edge.
Okay, so that's the Vx.
That's the Vx.
Oh, okay.
That's how you create an edge. Because right? Far above this point, the potential gets so high that I should leave all the energy levels empty.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, just a small question. The horizontal axis should be x instead of mu. Yeah.
Sorry. What I mean is my chemical potential is here.
Yeah.
And horizontal axis. Yes. Yeah. So Yeah, so that's it for today. And let me just say that so far what we've done are all within the free fermion, free particle picture. So essentially what we're doing is really single particle physics. The only thing we do occasionally that's many bodies to we decide to fill all the fermion levels that has negative energy or energy below chemical potential. Then we get insulators and so on. But in principle, everything that I've said pretty much can be done in some other settings as long as I have some waves moving in some media. So there, for example, this, you know, the semiconductor can be realized with photons because it's some waves moving, you know, as long as you can create some waves in a periodic potential. Or even this term band physics can be realized, mimicked using photons. But starting tomorrow, I'll be moving to interacting phases. So where some of the, you'll see that some of the intuition from free fermion theory remains, some of them will be gone. So tomorrow we'll do what's known as the Landau Fermi liquid theory. And next week we do superconductors.